Surprise! I promised you, dear listener, a surprise for this podcast, episode number 300 of Admissions Trade Talk, and I'm going to give it to you. Tune in to find out about today's guest and host, as two experienced admissions professionals reveal what can get you in and keep you out of your dream programs. Welcome to the 300th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in," and not only in, but in the best program for you. Now, you heard right. This is our 300th episode. And since those round numbers seem to beg for special treatment, I decided to do something that members of my staff have for several years asked me to do, be the interviewee. Jen Weld, Accepted Admissions Consultant and former Assistant and Associate Director of Admissions at Cornell Johnson's Executive MBA program, is going to be the interviewer. In a minute, I'm going to turn the mic over to her and climb into the hot seat. But first, I'd like to introduce our featured resource for this podcast, Fitting In and Standing Out, Accepted's free downloadable guide. Your application needs to show that you will do both, and that's the paradox at the heart of admissions. Master that paradox, and you are well on your way to acceptance. Download this free guide at accepted.com/FISO, fitting in, standing out. Again, that's accepted.com/FISO. Okay, Jen, it's time for you to take over.
Okay. Thank you, Linda, and thank you for inviting me to do this today. So our guest today, Linda Abraham, who you've heard a lot of in these 299 previous episodes, attended UCLA for both her bachelor's in political science and her MBA. She started Accepted in 1994 as Linda Abraham and Associates. After changing the name to Accepted in 1996, it was incorporated as Accepted.com in 1997. Linda is also the co-founder of the Association of International Graduate Admissions Consultants and the co-author of MBA Admissions for Smarties. She's often sought after by the media, including CBS News, The Wall Street Journal, Poets and Quants, Bloomberg Businessweek, and more for her admissions expertise. Linda, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
My pleasure. Why don't we get started? I'm here.
Why don't we get started with a question that you ask most of your guests typically. Why don't you give us a little bit of information about your background and why you decided to start Accepted?
Okay, well, the background really starts way back when I was a senior in college, and there was a lot of concern at the time about declining writing abilities because of the nefarious influence of influence in the 60s. And sounds rather quaint right now. So they were increasing the writing requirements of Poli-Sci 1 at UCLA. I was a political science major, but I'd also taken a lot of writing classes and English classes. So I was asked if I was interested in being a tutor for that course. And I actually absolutely love the work, but I didn't see how I could make a living at it. For me, it's fun helping somebody clarify their ideas, organizing material, editing it. I enjoyed it. It was like solving a puzzle. But I'm also the child of immigrants. And as such, my parents thought that you need a profession. And a profession meant you became a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, something very, very clearly defined. They had no illusions that I was going to be an engineer. So they weren't very happy when I wasn't entirely clear upon graduation what direction I wanted to go in. They were very happy when I decided to go for an MBA, and I was happy with that choice too. I got my MBA and got married in the middle of the program, and shortly after finishing it, we decided to start our family. And in the early 90s, my husband and I, we needed some more money just to make ends meet. I had along the way gotten my real estate license, but at the time, real estate was in a major slump in Los Angeles, and I just wasn't enjoying the work anymore. I wanted to do something that would allow me to work from home, work around our six children that at the time ranged in age from 2, 3 to 11, 12. They were the youngest and the oldest were 9 years apart. And I had a lot of writer friends, and I decided to go back to editing, which I had loved. So I advertised in UCLA's paper, the Daily Bruin, and I got some work. But I was frequently asked to edit personal statements and applications essays. And frankly, I just enjoyed that a lot more. I've always loved biographies and personal stories and historical fiction and things like that. It was just a lot more fun than research papers. I also experimented with writing experience pieces and such. I studied up on journalistic techniques for writing. And I realized that if people, applicants, applied some of the journalistic techniques, the storytelling techniques, to their personal statements and application essays, the essays would simply be more effective. And that's how Accepted started, as an editing service. The other thing that was really coming onto the popular scene at the time, or the commercial scene at the time in the mid-90s, was, of course, the internet. And the internet simply removed all geographic boundaries. So whereas when I first started, I was talking about people driving, say, within half an hour of my home then in Santa Monica, California, I could now work with people in Hong Kong or New York or anywhere in the world. So that was the other kind of boost to Accepted's growth. And it evolved over time with technology. It started out with paper applications and faxing things back and forth. Then there were disk-based applications, and then web-based applications, and almost everything being done via email, Skype, video conferencing, etc. So that's the origins of Accepted.
That's crazy to think. I mean, how to think of faxing things back and forth at this stage. Yeah. But that wasn't that long ago that was the primary medium. That's crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So other than technologically, how has admissions evolved since you started Accepted?
Well, I think one of the biggest differences is when I first started Accepted, most information about the admissions process was provided by the schools. The overwhelming majority, they really controlled the messaging about their process, their school, et cetera. Again, with the explosion of the internet, UA had an explosion of information, and the schools no longer were in control of that messaging, for better or for worse. I'm not saying it was good or bad. There were some good aspects to it, and there were some negative aspects to it. But that was certainly one of the biggest differences. Now you have, you know, information overload and glut and all that. The other big change is the work is increasingly international. And that occurred fairly quickly. But that was one major change. I never anticipated, and anybody who attends our webinars know I always start the webinars by asking, where's everybody located? Because to this day, I get a kick out of the international nature of our audience. You know, we'll have people logging on from South America and Australia and Asia and Europe and Africa all at the same time, all basically communicating with one another. To me, that's still amazing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think I've seen is just higher and higher test scores over the last 20 years. When I first started, a 700 was a really good test score on the GMAT, for example. You now have the new scoring system on the MCAT for medical school. And it started, the initial idea was that the mean should be 500 for accepted students, but it's been already, and it's only been out a few years, it's already been climbing, I think it's 509 or something like that. So that's something that the LSAT, I think, is an exception to that because of the implosion in the law school admissions market, but that's going to reverse now as that market starts to come back. So those are some of the changes that I've seen in admissions.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the test scores. Do you have any sense? I mean, because I've noticed that same thing. I mean, probably at this point, if I were to apply to business school, I'm not sure. Well, certainly with the score that I had back in the late 90s, I don't know if I would have gotten in. But
a lot of
do you
people
have any
sense?
Yeah. What you would attribute that to?
I would attribute
and
it to
can't be the smarter than us, could it?
No. I attribute it to two things. One, test prep. The test prep has evolved also. Some, I think, is test prep. Some is the increasing percentage of international students in the applicant pool. I once went to a presentation given by GMAC, and they showed graphs of how many hours do students stay that they studied from different regions in the world, and what are the average scores for different regions in the world. And there was a strong correlation between the amount of prep time applicants put in different regions of the world and the score. In other words, the more time spent prepping and studying, the higher the scores. So Asian students tended to study more. Asian students tended to have the higher GMAT scores. And I think the increasing numbers of Asian students coming to, for example, business school would drive those scores up. It's less of a factor for medical school admissions, where I think you just have people studying really, really hard, doing more and more test prep, maybe more individual tutoring to get those scores up.
So how has admissions consulting evolved over these last 20 plus years?
Okay. I think there are, it's grown. That's the biggest thing. There are far more consultants today in all fields than there were in 1996 when I put up Accepted for the first time. You did have some. I wasn't the only one, and I wasn't the first, but there were far fewer. And I remember when I first talked to my husband and said, you know, I really want to focus on admissions writing, or I tell friends that this is what I do. They'd look at me like I was crazy. Like, oh, you're going to make a business out of this? But because I had kept getting asked, I thought I could do it. And I didn't have any ambitions at the time of growing, you know, Accepted into a 20 plus consultant business. I just wanted to do it myself and do it part time. So that's the growth of the field, I think, is the most striking aspect of it. The second thing is the Association of International Graduate Admissions Consultants. It's a small association, but when I first started, I worked entirely in isolation. I didn't know anybody that did what I did, okay? And then I reached out to one consultant who was a little bit older than me and more experienced. And I said, let's get together for lunch. And we did. And we've been colleagues and friends ever since, Max Duffy. And it was wonderful for me. And then what happened was, I think it was 2004, Tuck decided to host a conference for admissions consultants and invited me and along with about 20 others. And they said, you can, you know, learn about our program. You can network with your colleagues. So anyways, the Tuck conference was excellent. I did learn a lot about Tuck. I learned some more about MBA admissions in general, and I found I really loved interacting with my colleagues. I learned a lot from them. I found it very beneficial. And that was the genesis of the Association of International Graduate Admissions Consultants. And it was, and it has been wonderful to be able to do that. So that's another, and I think it also professionalized and raised the set some standards for professionalism in the industry. The third thing, and I think at least partially an outgrowth of the existence of AGAC, is the increasing acceptance of admissions consultants as a part of the admissions scene by the schools. Okay, so when AGAC was founded, or when that conference was held at Tuck, and it was followed up by a session at GMAC, where several consultants that I had met at the previous year's conference went to GMAC and presented a seminar on what do admissions consultants do to admissions directors. Frankly, there was a lot of hostility. And if you talk, some directors were more accepting, some were, as I said, hostile, simply. That has changed. If it's not, it's at least moved towards acceptance. This is a reality. Admissions consultants are out there. They play a role. And in some cases, it's much more than mere acceptance. I was at the AGAC conference last summer, and the dean of Michigan Ross, Dean DeRue, said, you are our partners in educating people who are going to change the world. And I was thrilled. And I think that more and more that is the perception, that we help the schools get their message out there, because the informational marketplace now is very crowded. There are rumors, there's misinformation, disinformation, and the consultants that I know are trying to get the facts out there and really help the applicants get accepted. If it's working one-on-one with them, fine. If it's through podcasts and webinars and blog posts, the idea is to try and get the best information and really help the applicants get accepted, pursue their dream careers, pursue their dream trajectory in life, and have a positive impact on the world. So it's those are some of the changes that I've seen. Do you agree with that? I mean, you've been around too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that our job is to help our clients to really showcase the best of themselves. And, you know, I mean, having sat in an admissions chair myself, there have been some people that I've thought would have thought, you know, maybe on paper, they didn't look so great, you know, and thinking, man, when I interview this person, he or she's going to be a real dud just because their application wasn't, you know, just wasn't put together very well. But then having meeting them in person, interview totally changed my perception. And so, you know, if you can match those two things up front, then that's better for everybody. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we sometimes get emails from clients. I hope you realize that you're changing people's lives. And hey, that's a very rewarding kind of email and response. That's, you know, it's not necessarily how I started the business, but definitely the goal of the business.
Sure.
Purpose.
So at Accepted, we offer lots of different categories of consulting from undergrad, grad to med, medical school, MBA admissions, law admissions, PhD. Sort of how do the categories of those different types of consulting differ and how are they the same?
I think the same part of it is that in all the categories, the admissions committee is attempting to meet the applicant, to go beyond the test and the test score and the transcript or maybe a resume. They're trying to get to know a person. If they have to write a personal statement, it might be more about how they've gotten to this point in life. If it's a statement of purpose or a goals essay, it's what are your hopes and dreams and how do you plan to achieve them? And how is this program going to help you achieve them? But they are genuinely interested in the real story and meeting you through that either personal statement, statement of purpose, the letters of recommendation, the whole kit and caboodle. So that's something that's the same for all of them. You know, the expression, just be yourself, somebody else is already taken, it holds true here. So what are some of the differences? I think that the focus on goals is really, really important in business school admissions and most graduate specialties, not all, but you have to write a statement of purpose for most graduate specialties because the school wants to know what the purpose is of your studies. So again, that idea of having a goal, knowing why a purposeful, thoughtful approach to graduate admissions is really important, both for the MBA and for many, and almost any specialty that asks for a statement of purpose. I think in medicine, one thing that's very distinctive is the focus on fitness for medicine and exposure to clinical practice. Not that you've been practicing necessarily, but at least that you've been in a hospital or you've worked with sick people or perhaps their families is really, really important in medical school, whether that's MD, DO, in healthcare in general. Less of a focus on long-term goals. They don't really expect you to know what specialty you want to go into when you apply to medical school. They may want to know why you want to go to their program, but this focus on fitness for medicine, clinical exposure, and simply knowing what you're getting into, because it's a very demanding and rigorous road, is I think is distinctive to medical school and healthcare in general. In terms of law school, I think it is less goal focused than the MBAs. It does want to see some exposure to law. And I think there is an increasing trend, especially since the law market got so tough, in applicants knowing more about how they intend to use a degree. Mm-hmm. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it was just personal statement, tell us about you. And it was actually, it was the least demanding of all the graduate admissions processes, okay. Which surprised me when I first started working. I mean, lawyers have to write, but they write so much less than business school students or medical school students that I was like, this is a little bit weird. But anyways, that's how it is. Obviously, the process developed without looking at the other. So those would be probably the main differences. In terms of difficulty, I think medical school, as I indicated, is the most difficult and demanding process. It's the most rigorous. You know, you need high academics, you need clinical exposure, you need community service. The application process itself has a primary application and then secondary applications where each secondary is different for each program and they apply to 20 schools typically. You have interviews. It's a very demanding process. Next is the MBA because you have different essay prompts for each school. And if you want to do it effectively, you really have to tailor the essay to the school. Yes, your life won't change as you apply. Your past life won't change. But kind of what you're emphasizing and the nuances, that should be tailored to the question posed and the school you're applying to. Law and most graduate specialties require one personal statement or a statement of purpose, which the applicant can and should at least customize some of it for an individual program so that they can show some fit with that program. But it's still less demanding than either the MBA or the med process. So okay. Those are some of the differences.
Gotcha. Can you tell me what your most and least rewarding aspects of your work are?
Okay. The most rewarding by far is hearing from applicants, I'm accepted. That, you know, those emails, those letters, if we worked with them, it's great. If they just use the site and they send me the email, which I get those emails too. I want to thank you so much. You really helped me get into whatever it is. And I mentioned earlier, you know, you're changing people's lives. That's tremendously rewarding. And that really is our purpose and mission. And you get those emails too. Yep. And they're wonderful. They're a real perk of the job. And that's again, what the company is about. The least rewarding, well, conversely, is when somebody gets rejected and you've worked hard with them and they still don't make it. Fortunately, less than 20% of our clients are in that situation. I also find it troubling. Sometimes I'll talk with a prospective client and I have to give them bad news. I have to say, look, I think if you want to get into this particular program, you have to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, and J, which basically is telling them it's going to be really, really difficult for them to become competitive at that program. Sometimes people appreciate that advice or that input, and sometimes they don't. They feel I'm being negative or discouraging. I don't like to be negative or discouraging, but I also don't like to take people's money under false pretenses. So that I find a little, not only that it's not rewarding financially, but I just find it, again, I don't like to be discouraging. I'd rather be supportive and helpful, but it's part of the job. It's just not one of the funner parts.
Yep. So how about answering or finishing the statement? I know an applicant won't get accepted when?
When their stats are really low for the schools they're applying to. When they have a clue why they're doing what they're doing. That, again, that would be particularly for medicine and MBA. Law, that's a little bit less true, but not entirely. When, this isn't always true, but sometimes if they're basically taking a, just tell me what I have to write approach. Tell me what I have to do to get in. Not in terms of substance. Just what do I have to write? What do I have to say? What's the magic key that's going to unlock the door? And there are several keys that will unlock the door, but they usually involve effort. Mm-hmm. There's no magic wand.
That's true. So you alluded to earlier that, you know, you don't like to be discouraging to prospective clients, but you also don't want to take their money if there's really no shot for them. Are there clients that you've refused to work with?
Yes, but it's not on that basis. Okay. I don't like to, if somebody comes and I don't think they're going to get accepted, I will tell them, look, I think your chances are poor at this particular program. If this is your dream school, it's not my job to reject you. So let's do our best, but you need to be realistic. Let's apply to that school, but also apply to these schools where your chances are better. Or postpone your application, take steps, bum, 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 and improve your qualifications and then apply. But again, I don't think it's my job to say I'm not working you because you're not qualified. It is my job to advise them how to, in the way I see is best in their interest. If they still want to work with us, then we'll still work with them. We're not going to, again, we don't reject them on that basis. So on what basis would I refuse to work with a client? We've refused to work with clients who had a proxy doing their work for them, either a parent or an application agent. We simply will not do that. And to the extent that I've actually refunded money when a parent called, got information, which is fine. We talked once to the daughter And then the parent informed the consultant that she would be the primary point of contact because the daughter was too busy. Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, this is true. And I talked to the consultant and I said, I think we should refund it and not do it. And she said, I completely agree. And that's exactly what happened. So we will not work with proxies. We have to work with the applicant and we have to believe that the applicant is actually writing the essay. If we don't believe that, then we won't work with them. Mm-hmm. Or if we feel they copied it. We also have occasionally fired clients if we discovered they weren't doing their own work. We've also occasionally, very rarely, but if we had a client who was verbally abusive, I will not tolerate that.
Yep, absolutely. So do you have a story about, a particularly insightful story to share about a previous client that would be helpful for any listeners who are thinking about applying to programs?
Oh gosh, there's so many stories. One of my favorite stories is these stories are old stories, and I'll share a recent story. There was one client I met with, this was like really early in acceptance history when I was still meeting with clients one-on-one. And the fellow came and he was pursuing a very demanding program at UCLA. He was bright. He was personable. He was delightful to work with. And he'd gone to first to junior college and then he transferred to UCLA. And he had had an undiagnosed learning disability. I forget. It might have been dyslexia. I'm not sure. Or it might have been. It might have been ADD. I'm not sure at this point anymore. And he was told in high school that he was never going to amount to anything.
Yikes!
And I said that teacher should have been fired. He was. By the time I talked to him, he had close to a 4.0 in a very demanding science program at UCLA. He was applying to medical school. He was on committees working with students with disabilities. He was tutoring a blind student in chemistry using Tinker Toys for chemical structures. He was just this incredible, talented human being. And in junior college, he was diagnosed with whatever the learning disability was. He got accommodations and he just began to soar. And the last I heard was I think he was pursuing a residency in neurology.
Oh, wow. That's okay. Amazing.
And I was like, he just kept plugging away and he refused. And I said to him, I said, how did you feel when that stupid high school teacher told you that? He said, I felt terrible. And he says, and all along, I felt like I knew the material. I just couldn't spit it back on a test. Mm-hmm. And again, as he was growing up, even though his mother was a psychologist, he didn't, the concept of learning disabilities, and this would have been mid 90s, so it probably would have been late 80s, early 90s, wasn't as well understood.
Yep.
So that was his experience. And I found his experience absolutely inspiring. Another, again, early experience was a lovely young woman came to work with me. And again, this was day one, and when I was still meeting with people in my office, and really, really nice. I liked her. And she said, I said, when we were talking, she was applying to law school. And I said, at some point, she told me a little about her background. And I said, what do you want to write about? And she said, I want to write about my trip to, I'm not going to say the place because it doesn't really matter, what the country where her family was from. And I said, oh, that sounds really interesting because it's not a commonly traveled place. I said, that sounds really interesting. When were you there? She says, oh, I was never there. I said, then how do you want to write about your trip to this place? She says, well, I haven't really done anything terribly interesting. And I know a lot of people who visited this country. So I want to write about that. And I was rather naively shocked. and I said to her, I said, do you have a background in creative writing? And she says, no. I said, well, neither do I. I said, why don't you tell me what you have done and let's see if there's something there.
Yep.
And she wrote this really, really fine essay that is to this day a sample essay on the site. So
And it wasn't about her pretend visit to
country. It was very real. It was very real. It had to, you know, I'm not going to go into what it was because I don't want to reveal too much here, but it's on the site. It was a very good essay, and just knowing about her, it was her. It was definitely her. She got accepted at her dream school. In the end, I think she decided not to go because of a boyfriend. But it was, you know, again, at that point, discussing ethics, I don't think would have worked. Mm. But drawing her out, I think she was just somebody facing temptation and at least momentarily succumbing. And in the end, she told her real story, and it was a really, really good one. So that
I think that's a really, you know, that's a really good point, because I think I work with a lot of clients who, yeah, there's this idea with some of them that, you know, I just don't have anything. There's nothing interesting in my background. I'm so cookie cutter. I'm just like everybody else. And time and time again, I mean, 100% of the time, there is something in there that's really interesting.
Everybody has a story.
It's my job as a consultant to help, you know, the clients figure that out. But, and it's really rewarding to do that, because oftentimes it'll be like, really, you want me to write about that? I'm like, trust me, write about that. I have been sitting in an admissions chair myself, reading hundreds of applications and falling asleep with the boring ones about, you know, some boring work example. Like, tell us about the time you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, or, you know, whatever it was. I mean, it doesn't have to be as extreme as that.
But, no, it doesn't at all.
But, I always was trying to, when possible, with questions that are very open-ended, don't use a work example. Use something from your personal life, because that's really what's going to show your uniqueness.
Right. Or balance the work examples with the personal examples, depending upon the nature of the question. Those two stand out, even though they're from a long time ago. Another one that stands out recently is somebody that worked with a medical school consultant and just came from a very disadvantaged background, and we were able to help him. And he'd had some academic struggles, but he was very, very determined, and we were able to help him get into medical school. So here you had somebody, like I said, who was very in terms of, you know, financial disadvantage, you know, from underrepresented group in medicine. And he was able, with our help, to overcome those disadvantages. And he's now in medical school. He's a M1.
Great.
You know, another example would be somebody who came to us, wasn't quite ready to apply, took the advice to postpone his medical school application, and took several steps that were recommended by his consultant to prepare for a successful medical application, applied in June, got his secondaries out really fast, and was accepted in October. So, you know, he's thrilled.
Yep.
And he knows he's going to medical school. Yeah, actually, I think he was accepted a couple of programs. Or, you know, we had one MBA applicant this year who had a really interesting background, excellent work experience, but his GMAT was definitely low. And his essays, when he came to us, were not what they should have been. And he got in at, you know, 3 M7 schools that most people would give their IT for. Yeah. So those kinds of stories are really rewarding. Or sometimes it could be, I'm thinking of one of Esmeralda's clients who was applying and getting really, really, really frustrated with the process. He actually got sick. And then she directed him to a particular program that was more appropriate for him, both in terms of his goals and in terms of his qualifications. And he got in, and he wrote the most beautiful email to me about how she helped him and how he felt like he had this friend guiding him through the process, really looking out for his best interests. Those kinds of stories, you know, they really, really make a difference.
Yeah. All right, so dare to dream here for a minute, Linda.
Okay.
If you could be an admissions director for a day, what would you change about the process?
I think I would make the recommendations less burdensome. I mean, it's kind of an odd thing for me to choose, but I think the letter recommendation system is somewhat broken, especially in the B-school realm. I would have common apps, common, sorry, not common apps. I'm actually opposed to common apps. I would have common letters of recommendation so that recommenders could fill out, you know, one letter and it would go to all the schools that the applicant's applying to. And I'd probably have two recommenders. I think medical schools sometimes have five. And again, they're applying to 20 programs. That's burdensome.
Yeah.
And the schools are asking this of people, basically, as they're asking the app, they're demanding the applicants ask favors of people mm-hmm. who are very busy, have multiple demands on their time. And I just think it's not good. I think in some specialties, it's fairly common and accepted for the applicants to draft the recommendation for the recommender's signature. That's not accepted in business school. Mm-hmm. And I think that the system there is it's better than it used to be, largely because of AGAC. Because AGAC did a survey that kind of showed how many of the recommendations were written by the applicants for the recommender's signature. I'm not talking about forged recommendations. That's a whole separate yeah. chapter. I'm talking about where the recommender says, look, I'm really busy. Write something for my signature. I'll review it and then, you know, either edit it or sign it. That's common in the business world all the time. Secretaries write letters for their boss's signature. You know, lawyers write for people's signature. But business school, it's considered improper.
Yep.
You know, so I'm not saying if you want that kind of authenticity and commitment from the recommenders, which I can understand why the schools want it. They want that other voice. They want that other perspective. Otherwise, the letter isn't really giving them what they want. But you have to make it easier for the recommenders.
Yeah.
I think law school admissions is moving towards common recommendations. Medical schools are experimenting with committee letters, but I think what you need is really to streamline that part of the process.
And I mean, obviously you're really plugged in with admissions directors. I mean, because it sounds like primarily a business school problem. Do you bring this up with other admissions directors, and what are their thoughts on it?
It has been brought up at AGAC. Okay, I think occasionally admissions directors will ask us the question that you asked me, what would you guys change about the admissions process? And I would, and that would be one thing that I would go right for. And I know it's been discussed. Apparently it's very difficult for the schools to get together and decide on one common recommendation.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem. I think, you know, in particular with the business schools, the medical schools probably go too far the other way. Some of them, at least, they have these really burdensome writing requirements. I think the business schools have cut way back on the writing requirements. And I think sometimes they don't really have the information where they can get to know their applicant unless they interview them. So,
yeah.
You know, that's obviously the business schools, they have to weigh resources and if you ask too many questions, then you're going to get fewer applicants and, you know, then you don't look as exclusive and it costs money to read a lot of essays. So I think, ironically, I think one question, one school that I think has really nailed the MBA essay interview, essay requirement act is Harvard, which asks for only one question. And that question is, what else would you like us to know?
Yep.
I think it's an excellent question.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
No word limit. And the applicant can really tell their story and show some judgment or lack of it.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. All right, let's turn to rankings. How do you feel about rankings?
I think that the data that the rankings supply in a fairly easy, accessible location. In other words, you don't have to go to each website to get the data. And presumably it's comparable. In other words, they say, you know, this is how you should provide this statistic. This is how you should provide that statistic. I think that is the value in the rankings. I don't think the actual ranking is that useful. Okay. Because rarely are schools going to be rarely are rankings going to be measuring what's important to the individual applicant. So if they're going strictly by the ranking and the ranking is measuring something that they don't care about, it's kind of silly. Now, that being said, I think U.S. News is a fairly good reputational ranking, but it's not so much whether it's number three or number five, whether it's number five or number 50, or maybe number five or number 25, that can be relevant. And it can be relevant when you have choices. In other words, you've been accepted at two schools. They both support your goals. One is ranked number five, one is ranked number 25. They're both cost the same, assuming there's no difference in cost. You can probably assume that placement is going to be much better in number five. The network is going to be better in number five. But if you're talking about number five and number eight, I don't think you're going to see a great big difference. You might see a difference in your particular area of interest, and that's what you should be focusing on, both in terms of career placement, in terms of the curriculum. That's what you should be really, really, really focusing on in terms of extracurriculars. And then layer in personal preference, and suddenly you're making an intelligent decision.
Yeah, agree. And what are your thoughts on employers when they consider rankings when they're in their recruiting process?
I don't think they're, you know, looking at whether you went to school number three or number five. I think that schools' overall reputations is going to matter much more to recruiters. I interviewed the head of recruiting for Bain not long ago, and I don't think the term rankings came up in the entire hour. Do they have a sense? They have graduates of different schools working for them. They're going to see that certain graduates, you know, consistently perform well. Certain schools produce graduates that consistently perform well, and certain schools don't. And that's going to, have much more influence on the recruiter's future recruiting than rankings.
What do you say? So I sometimes get this question from prospective clients. It's more a statement that if I don't get into a top 10 school, there's no point in me going.
That depends where they're starting from, and that depends what they want to do. Okay, if they're a software engineer and they want to move into product development, well, they may just need certain skills and knowledge in order to make that move. And then they have to determine if the schools they get accepted to are worth, you know, and the anticipated increase in income plus increased satisfaction they're going to get from being a product manager is worth the investment. Now, if you look at GMEC data, overwhelmingly, applicants are very satisfied and happy they went to business school and got an MBA. If you look at, and this is true, well, we're talking now about the MBA. It's the whole top 10 thing in medicine doesn't count. Law school, it's very relevant. If you want to work for big law, where you go, what school you graduated from can be really, really important. If you want to work in a really specific location, a specific state, for example, then again, where you go may be really important, but may not be the ranking. It may just be what, you know, what school is in your location could be more important. But getting back to the MBAs and their fixation on the top 10, which usually has about 15 schools in it, or the M7. I really think it depends on where they're starting from. If somebody went to Harvard undergrad or an Ivy, you know, and worked at McKinsey for 4 years, or maybe worked at Goldman Sachs and then went into private equity for 2 years, they probably do have to stay in the top 10 for it to make sense for them. But if you go back to the software programmer who wants to move into product development and management, or maybe even brand management ultimately, they probably need the MBA to do what they want to do. And it may not have to be in the top 10. They may be able to get do very, very well by going to programs outside the top 10 if they can't get into the top 10.
Mm-hmm. So is it better to be a top student at an average school or an average student at a top school?
It's better to be at a school where you're going to thrive. Okay. If you are at a school where you're miserable, you're not going to do well. And I think that's, you know, that is really important in terms of taking advantages of the opportunities offered at any graduate program. So you have to look at multiple factors. It's not just the brand. It's what you want to get out of it. It's what you want to do. If you are a medical student, you may want to, you know, which is a very long, again, a very long road. It's 4 years of medical school. If you're in a high cost of living city, paying medical tuition full rate, you're going to end up with several hundred thousand dollars of debt. And you might be better off at a lower ranked program in a lower cost of living state, or at a program where you can live at home. If you can, you know, those are all things that you have to weigh in order to determine what is the best program for you. Again, ranking in particular in medicine is, I think, a little bit less important. As long as you're going to an allopathic U.S. medical school, then you're going to have lots of opportunities. I think the ranking, reputation, top school, et cetera, probably is more important in business school and law school of the professional programs. But I think the most important thing is to determine where you're going to thrive, both personally, educationally, and ultimately professionally.
And how best can you determine where you're going to thrive?
That's a really good question. I think you can determine that by the easiest way is looking thoroughly at the website and the social media of the schools that you're considering, and presumably that have accepted you at this point. But we're talking about people who are already accepted. But I'd go beyond that. If at all possible, you want to visit the school. You know, if you can attend an admit weekend, do so. And that'll help you determine, which school is right for you. We frequently hear back from accepted clients who've been admitted in multiple schools that one school just felt right. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very common kind of response. They were accepted at 3, 4, 5 really good programs, but one school just felt better. And that's fine. And that's what you get when you visit. If you can't visit, or in addition to visiting, talk to current students and recent alumni, and especially talk to students in the areas that you are most interested in. Also, just reflect on what's important to you. Some people want to go to a place they've never been to, and they want to meet a whole new crowd of people, and the diversity is really important to them. Other people, they want to know that they're going to have a group that's like them at a particular program, whether that's defined by ethnicity, religion, politics, whatever it is, whatever is important to you. If it's important that there be that kind of group at your school, then make sure it's there. Or if you say, no, I want a really diverse, I want to go to a whole new place, that's fine. But just know which group you're in. Know if weather is important to you. You know, I'm an Angeleno. I've been an Angeleno all my life. If it gets below 40, I think it's really cold. You know, would I tolerate really cold weather? Chicago, where I understand it's minus something today. what is it, Chicago? It's like minus 13 or something really crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, or Tuck, which is beautiful. I probably would have in my 20s. I'm not sure I would do it today. But, if that's important to you, or if you love winter sports, if that's important to you, then just weigh it in. Throw it into the mix.
Yep. Absolutely.
Big city, small city, urban, rural. Throw it into the things that are going to make you happy and thrive or not.
Wholeheartedly agree. So looking back in the 20 plus years that you've been doing this, is there anything that you would have done differently?
In terms of accepted, I would have started webinars sooner. I probably would have started the podcast sooner. I would have, I think, developed certain of our service options sooner. Looking back, there are things that work and I'm like, why didn't I do that sooner? You know, that kind of stuff. I would have, again, except it started as an editing service. I think I should have realized more quickly that we evolved very rapidly into a full service admissions consultancy. And like, mm-hmm. I wasn't, I, you know, that's sometimes when you're too close to something. But
How about conversely, what do you see for the future of Accepted?
I see continued growth because we had our best year ever last year, and it was our third best year ever. So that's something good. I see continued diversification. So we have a lot of MBA applicants. We have a lot of med applicants, but we're growing in other grad, and our law business is growing. We're growing in other graduate fields, you know, PsyD, psychology, PhD, Masters of Engineering. And we're hiring people who have those backgrounds to service the specific needs of those applicants and clients. So I see continued growth and it kind of like, you know, focusing more on different niches and at the same time expanding and diversifying.
Sure. All right. So I've got just one last question for you.
Okay.
To prospective applicants listening to this podcast, when you look back at all of your experience, what's the one thing you'd like to make sure they take away from listening today?
What is the one thing I'd like them to do? That they should, this is going to sound cliched because so many admissions directors say it. They should look at the process as an introduction of themselves to the admissions committee. In other words, they should try and be authentic in the process. Now, authenticity does not mean, you know, true confessions. Yeah, you want to present yourself through your application, but it's your best self.
Mm-hmm.
Present your best self through your application. And sometimes, which is why Accepted is here, you can benefit from a coach or a third party who has a little perspective, not to mention experience, with that process.
Excellent. Well, Linda, thank you so much for joining me today, or allowing me to join you today, whatever we want to say. Really been a pleasure. And listeners, we will include links in the show notes at accepted.com/300, which, by the way, are written by me, to the resources mentioned in this podcast, including Fitting In and Standing Out, our featured resource today, and other relevant podcasts. And thank you, too, for joining us for Admission Straight Talk Special 300th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please tell your friends. Make sure they don't miss any future shows, be they with deans, admissions professionals, professors, current students, test prep pros, or alumni doing great things. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm Jen Wells. Linda will be back hosting next week. Thank you.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.